Man, good evening. You are listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Whether you're picking us up on Channel 46, Trust Cable in Alabama, satellite virtual channel W3957, on your C-band satellite dish, kickradio.com or scaredmonkeys.com/radio, it's always nice to have you. Tonight, the Dana Pretzer Show begins in just a minute. Larry Sinclair will be here to talk about the Parent Act. And you're going to say, what is the Parent Act? The Parent Act is the Parental Abduction Recovery Enforcement and Network Training Act. It's important. We've done a lot of shows in the past about children who have been abducted by a parent and taken to Japan, and we're going to follow that up with some proposed legislation. Then Jossie Manser will be here, the managing editor of Diario, to talk about this nonsense that Bill O'Reilly and Geraldo Rivera, yeah, they backtracked a little bit, but I noticed O'Reilly hasn't done a thing about it tonight. I haven't been able to see the email segment of his program, where they say that Natalie Holloway died of a cocaine overdose. So we're going to attack that. And then LaDonna Meredith will be here. She's with the Let's Bring Them Home group. They are a national missing persons advocacy group. And they're talking about a new project they have called Project Dead Zone. Then J. Paul Derritani will be here, and we're going to be talking about that NBC show where they go around and they look for, on Dateline, they look for sexual predators. There's a lawsuit that's come out of that where one of these sexual predators has committed suicide, or actually committed suicide. He was a prosecutor as they were going to arrest him. So that's here tonight on Scared Monkeys Radio and the Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be back in just a minute with Larry Sinclair. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. Again, in the past, we've done many a show about parents who have taken children, spouses who have taken children, abducted children to Japan, and the whole nightmare that is involved in that. We're going to follow up and continue on with that same line of programming here and talk about the Parental Abduction Recovery Enforcement and Network Training Act, or the Parent Act. It aims to prevent interstate and international parental abduction by providing greater governmental resources to stop parental abduction, recognizing the protection of parental rights that are guaranteed in the United States Constitution, constructing policies that will mandate strict enforcement of laws pertaining to parental abduction prevention, and promotion and distribution of educational programs about child abduction prevention in areas that are weakest. And we have Larry Sinclair on the line with us tonight. Hi, Larry.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going good. Nice to have you on the program with us tonight. I've done 6, 7, 8 shows on the whole abduction issue to Japan, with different parents from the United States, overseas, Canada, you name it. It was a story that I have to admit no one had really heard about. Well, I shouldn't say that. A story that wasn't really that prevalent in the media, and my audience and myself were quite shocked to hear a lot about it. And in fact, you have your own story to tell before we get into the Parent Act, and I thought we'd start with that and then talk about this piece of proposed legislation.
Well, basically, yeah, it's a typical story like many other parents, where the courts think, hey, what's wrong with sending a child to a country that's not going to enforce U.S. custody orders? In this case, the judge thought it was okay for my my son's mother to go ahead and take our son to Moscow. He was born in Fresno, California. He's American, entitled to his rights and all that, And hey, guess what? He should go on over to Russia. And we did warn the judge about the problems that could arise from that. First of all, that Russia doesn't have any legal mechanisms to enforce any U.S. custody orders, and the fact that also Russian courts also hold anti-American sentiment. And so because of that, the judge didn't take that into consideration and said, we're going to go ahead and allow that to happen. And I haven't seen my son now for about 8 years because of that.
Are the judges just that naive? Are they not educated, or is it an arrogance in a lot of these cases coming from the bench?
I would say mostly lack of education, but there's going to be some arrogance. I think in my case there was an issue of both. The judge had gone through, just recently at that time, had gone through a divorce and also a very nasty custodial dispute with her divorce and all that.
Oh, good Lord.
And so I would say, I personally, of course, I don't have the facts to back it up, only from what I've been told. But I would say that there was some prejudice on that part. But at the same time, I think it was also ignorance. The judge had a prior background of being an assistant prosecutor, no family law background before she was elected as judge. And, of course, it reflected on her decision. We told the judge that we had an issue regarding Russia enforcing the custody orders, and the judge just thought, you know what, I'm not going to take that at issue. So, yeah, education, I think, had to do with the majority of the judges, especially with the judges that made the rulings, the recent rulings in Japan. They didn't take that in consideration, and they're willing to go ahead and allow children to go to Japan. Of course, Japan's going to go ahead and disregard the parents over here in the United States regarding their custodial rights.
We use the term child snatching, and education has to do a lot with the media, myself included, in educating not only myself but the public. People don't know this, but I'm going to read here from a overview of the epidemic of parental child snatching. Child snatching is an epidemic. Well, over 200 cases of parental child abductions occur each day in the United States. That's really unbelievable and shocking. And why aren't we doing more about it? Your comments.
Sounds like that's from the former New York Supreme Court Justice William Riegler, who mentioned about that. He also states in parental snatching that there is an average of 10,000 cases a year of children taken to foreign countries. And yes, it is a crime according to the International Parental Kidnapping Crime Act, which is under Title 18 USC Section 1204. It is a federal crime. The problem is, again, going back to lack of education, we don't have the people who are knowledgeable of this crime. And, of course, it's also a crime in all 50 states. They rather regard it as a civil issue. Education is needed, and that's the problem, is that we're not getting the education across to local, state, and federal authorities.
Diplomacy between governments, again, talking to Canadians, Americans, people from overseas. One of the questions I would ask these parents when they come on my program is, has your government been able to help you? And every response was, there was so-and-so and such department that was very nice, and we're quite concerned, but that's about as far as it went. Let's talk about the diplomatic issue here.
that is seems to be all they can do is just diplomatic talk. It's all talk and no action. That's usually done through the U.S. State Department. That's through the Office of Children's Issues, which has faced several congressional hearings because of their diplomatic talks. And that's all it's been, is diplomatic talks. They, for example, Assistant Secretary of State going to Saudi Arabia and claiming, you know, hey, we'd like to talk about the issue of child abduction. Okay, let's talk about it. They talk about it, but do any kids come back? Not really. They don't come back at all. And that also goes with other governments. The State Departments do recognize some countries as not being diplomatic enough to bring children back, but that's all they do. They still would rather go ahead and provide talks rather than providing action. And that's one of the reasons for the Parent Act, is that you guys have talked enough. And so while you guys are going over and doing your little talk, I want to transfer the duties and responsibilities of international child abduction over to the Justice Department and assign it to a specific division that would focus solely on interstate and international child abduction, with mandatory policies that they provide the investigation and prosecution of abductors.
When, and we're going to get into the crux of it here in a minute, but I have one more question, and we're going to use the Japanese example, if you don't mind. When we talked about the Japanese cases, it seemed to me, again, from the interviews that I've done, that the United States government was more interested in establishing relations with the Japanese than actually doing anything to help these parents who have had their children kidnapped. We all saw the former Prime Minister of Japan and the President of the United States swiveling their hips at Graceland here not that long ago and admiring Elvis Presley. Well, we all love Elvis, but that's not doing much to help bring children back from Japan. Where do we look when it comes to this? Is it just lip service, some of this information that we're giving out, or do we need something with some meat that can actually force these governments to work together to return these children?
Actually, and you hit it right on the nose. OCI, the Office of Children's Issues, is strictly lip service. And unfortunately, that lip service is not going to bring our kids back. With Japan and with other countries like Russia and China and other countries that we're supposed to have agreements with, called the Hague Convention, which a lot of them don't comply with, we have tried to, again, provide lip service and say, hey, by the way, you know, you guys are supposed to be cooperating with us since we are adhering to your custody orders. How about if you do the same? And, of course, they say no. But we continue with that same lip service. And there is an investigative reporter named Joel Mulbray who wrote a very impressive book called Dangerous Diplomacy, and he devotes one chapter about international child abduction and how lip service has not been there to get our kids back. Let me quickly emphasize, dangerous diplomacy is about the State Department that has done everything to maintain foreign relations at the risk of America's security. Under this chapter, it talks about at the risk of our own children. In this case, OCI has done everything to try and kind of smooth the foreign relation feathers with lip service rather than taking hard action and trying to bring back our children. So, we do need something up front that's going to have teeth. We need something that's going to take a bite out of these people, out of these other countries that don't adhere to our countries. And if that means being able to provide mandatory policies to prosecute and these abductors, whether it's through the International Parental Kidnapping Crime Act or whatever, we need it.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, Larry Sinclair is here, and we're talking about the Parent Act, the Parent Abduction Recovery Enforcement and Network Training Act. Tell us about it. How did you get to author this proposed legislation?
I'm a reporter also. I've worked for various radio services, and I love to write. And people have said, why don't you put your skills, you know, into something that could help out people, and had a few friends that asked me to try and create something in California. It later on became the Sinclair Cannon Act, named after my son and after Shelby Cannon, who was abducted and taken to the UK. And the Sinclair Cannon Act, which is now California Family Code 3048, basically instructs the judges to recognize certain red flags of abduction and to take specific measures to prevent these, to prevent abduction from occurring, such as custody bonds or mirror orders or supervised visitation, things like that. The whole purpose is for the child to be raised by both parents. Now, after that passed, I mean, it was supported from the California District Attorney's Association to the to John Walsh of America's Most Wanted.
Right.
So after that success, people said, hey, you need something bigger. So I started looking at research and looked at stuff that was written by the National National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, from the American Bar Association, from the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention at the Department of Justice. And I took a conglomerate of all these ideas and said, you know what, we have a lot of great ideas, but the problem is nobody's not doing anything about it. So let's get rid of the people who are at the focus of not implementing these ideas, of not taking the action, that's OCI, and let's go over to the Department of Justice. Now, the problem with the Department of Justice is, under the Child Exploitation Obscenity Section, those people put international child abduction at the bottom of the totem pole.
Jeez.
So I don't want to go ahead and give it to them. I'd rather create a division that deals strictly with interstate international child abduction, and that would be called the CARE Unit, which stands for the Child Abduction Recovery Education Unit.
And we're just about to talk that. See, you're a good reporter. You knew what my next question would be. Ultimately, a parent, the goal of this whole piece of legislation, or the goal of any parent, is to make sure that something like this doesn't happen when it comes to an order, a court proceeding. But if it does, the ultimate goal of that parent is recovery of their child that rightfully belongs to them. Let's talk about the part of the legislation that deals with the recovery and the enforcement.
Well, the problem with recovery is that we don't have recovery. Even with interstate child abduction, and I'm dealing right now with not with stranger abduction, but with family abduction, the majority of these cases are dealt as civil issues.
Right.
For example, here in San Antonio, there was a case where the custodial parent, the father, was beaten up by a guy who was hired by the non-custodial mother to take the child. And so the guy went and beat up the father, beat up the grandmother, took the child, gave it to the mother. They fled over, I would presume, over to Mexico. And the San Antonio police didn't jump on board. They considered it a civil issue. Hmm. Not assault and battery, not child kidnapping, but they considered it a civil issue. And that's the problem, is that, again, there was no means of recovery, even with the resources that we're supposed to depend on. And that becomes even a liability issue, because our parental rights are protected under the 14th Amendment. And suddenly, when we are asking our own government, hey, our child was taken to another country, where is your provision to protect our parental rights? And the problem is, there's nothing there, because majority of the time, OCA is not going to do anything about it. And of course, you're going to find a lot of U.S. attorneys who would prefer to deal with other issues rather than international child abduction. Why? Because in their eyes, international child abduction is a civil issue. It's something that's on the bottom of the totem pole. And that even comes from an FBI spokesperson who I interviewed in about 4 years ago, in which she told me that child abduction is not a serious issue. We'd rather deal with things like murder and child abuse.
Good.
However,
Lord.
Child abuse is deemed in our federal and state courts, and even in a lot of our laws, as an insidious form of child abuse.
Absolutely. And an asinine response from that FBI agent. The response that you've received from parents that have, obviously I was contacted by a parent who I've had on this program to speak to you. What have you heard from parents that are going through this right now?
A lot of them are always asking, where do I go? What do I do? Now, what do I tell them? Go ahead and contact the U.S. Attorney's Office. That's going to use his or her discretionary power to not handle the case, because that usually happens about 90-95% of the time.
Right.
Do I tell them go to the State Department, who's just going to sit there and, if you're lucky, maybe arrange a telephone call or maybe a welfare check? Case in point, by the way, right now on September 2nd will be the 8th year anniversary of my son's abduction, and right now OCI has done nothing more than trying to arrange a welfare check of my son. And that's what these parents are going to be able to face, the same thing, welfare checks and telephone calls, but never will be given the chance to be reunited with their kids, because we have no resources for that. And going back to the Parent Act, that is going to focus on those main problems. Get OCI out of the picture, because they're much more on diplomacy rather than reuniting kids with the parents, and focus on an agency that will have mandatory policies to bring the kids back. That's why the Parental Act adds, in the acronym, there is enforcement and there is network training. And that means everybody's going to be trained to be able to enforce parental rights.
Now, this is not only just a United States issue, it's an international issue. Have you been contacted by anyone in any other jurisdiction for help in legislation there being written?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I had one parent that was curious to hear about the Parent Act in Australia, because they also have the same problems over there. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of the same problems in many, many, many of the countries. The only thing that gets me is that these countries that are signatories under what's called the Hague Convention of Civil Aspects of International Child Abduction, is that these countries will provide legal services for these foreign parents to get their kids. Now, case in point, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, or as we call it, NCMEC, does a fantastic job on handling incoming cases, that is, foreign kids being abducted, taken to the United States. And 95% of the time, the United States will cooperate and bring and take those kids back to the habitual residence, that is, the country that they've been have resided for the past 6 months. Now, the issue is that, what about us parents? The problem is the Hague Convention is not applicable for us to get legal assistance. So if anything else, the Hague Convention does apply better for foreign parents than it does for American parents, because our own government doesn't want to flip the bill for any type of legal representation when our kids are taken to a foreign country. But to answer your question in regards to parents asking about this, yes, it is a crime. It is worldwide, and it is wrong. And there are countries that do not respect parental rights, and a good example would be Japan.
Right.
If you're divorced and you're in Japan and you're a father, you can kiss your rights goodbye.
Yeah, and that's unbelievable. And we're going to continue covering that that story here on the program. What's next for you, Larry? This is proposed legislation. What's the timeline?
Well, there's no timeline. Frankly, I think it should have been done many, many years ago.
Exactly.
Senator Dianne Feinstein is, I've been told that her office, from her office, that they're going to go ahead and pass it over to the legislative director for review. No promises of sponsorship yet. I have been getting letters of support from missing children's organizations and also from parents of abducted children trying to press the senator to support this bill. But basically, that's where I'm at right now. Right now, I'm trying to get this bill across because, to me, my issue regarding my son who's been abducted is never going to get resolved until OCI is out of the picture, and that also stands for the hundreds of thousands of other parents of missing kids. We are not going to get any answer until that bill is passed. So I'm encouraging everybody to send a letter to Senator Feinstein, to fax a letter to her and say, hey, you know, support the Parent Act. You know, it's a good bill. It's being supported by missing kids,
right,
or missing children's organizations and parents of missing kids, so, or abducted children. So get on board, help us out, and let's get some of these kids back home.
And if we can't help our kids and families that have abducted kids, I don't know who we can help. How can people find out more about the Parent Act?
Basically, all you got to do is just Google it, really.
Okay.
There's several missing children's, abducted children's organizations that have it, have the Parent Act on there. I'd say just go ahead and Google the Parent Act, and you're going to get four, five, six missing children's organizations that will be able to write about it. You can also contact me by email. That's at lsinclair@yahoo.com. L as in Larry, Sinclair, S-Y as in Yankee, and it's in Nancy, C-L-A-I-R, @yahoo.com. Go ahead and ask me for it. I'll send you a copy of the Parent Act, and if you have any questions, I'll gladly answer them.
Thanks, Larry. I'm going to stay in touch because this is a story that we need to follow.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Take care.
This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name is Dana Pretzer. If you happen to catch an episode of Bill O'Reilly's The Factor, last week, I think it was last Thursday, he did a segment with Geraldo Rivera where they came forward with a claim that they had credible source information that Natalie Holloway had died from a drug overdose, cocaine in particular. I did a daily commentary on that today, talking about what an actual credible source is and what credible source information is. I'm hearing from listeners that O'Reilly didn't comment on that tonight. A lot of you were quite disappointed in it. And I thought we'd go to Jossie Manser, managing editor of Diario in Aruba tonight, to talk about this claim and other news that has come forward in the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. Hi, Jossie.
Hi, Dana.
How are you this evening?
Pretty good, thank you.
Now, you heard this claim also on the O'Reilly Factor the other evening. It's caused a whole bunch of controversy. Let's start with that and I get your comments, please.
Well, you know, it's very hard for me to accept that any credible source here in Aruba would issue such a statement, because it's contrary to anything that is within reason. I mean, for you to be able to say that this girl died from an overdose of cocaine, there must have been an autopsy, there must have been a body, there must have been a direct eyewitness, there must have been a direct confession by one of the suspects.
Exactly.
I mean, to come out of the blue and say a credible source that you cannot prove, I think it's very foolish, and it opens the doors to a lot of rumors and commentaries that are not pertinent to the case.
It was just tabloid journalism, as far as I'm concerned. You've been a journalist for a long time, Jossie, and I don't imagine you or your reporters would come forward with something like that.
Absolutely not. We have to research our things thoroughly, because whatever you publish today can blow up in your face tomorrow if you don't have the evidence to back it, or you don't have a very reliable source indeed. But it has to be something that is within logic. You can't just say that someone died from an overdose if there wasn't any kind of a medical examination that took place afterwards. I mean, you have to research your facts very well before you can publish or go public with such a statement.
Now, they're claiming their source is a law enforcement official, a higher up, and you and I could probably pick who that law enforcement official is if this is actually true. And I have no doubt that they got some information and they ran with it. However, they never researched it. But last time you were on the program, you and I talked about this Amigo article that came out with a whole bunch of different wild rumors, speculation at best. Do you think this is tied into that and they were just looking for a U.S. audience and fed O'Reilly this information?
I think there is something of truth in that, because it seems to be a concerted effort by different factors that have come together to try to let's put it this way, to try to liberate the island from the suspicions of being unsafe. Aruba is a safe island. I mean, we who live here know that. But we know it because we know that there are certain places we won't go to, certain things we won't do, like anywhere else in the world. But to come up with this concerted effort to try to whitewash something bad that happened, I think it's wrong. I think it doesn't favor the island at all, in any sense whatsoever.
Since last week, or last time you were on my program, I've received some questions from listeners, and if it's okay with you, Jossie, I'd like to ask you them.
Sure.
And you and I covered this last program, and I think we've covered it before that, but in fact, the email starts here one more time. Is it only rumor that Lorenzo Van Ran is the illegitimate son of Paulus Vandersloot? Is this admitted by any of the admitted parties? And is there any new evidence or anything at all to connect Lorenzo to the disappearance of Natalie Holloway?
You know, as far as we know, no. We haven't been able to make that kind of a link or connection whatsoever with regards to the case. I mean, the rumors are more than rumors in Aruba that they are half-brothers, and they have the same appearance, the same height, same affections. There are many reasons to believe that, but it has not been confirmed by themselves, the two players themselves, or anyone else in the family related to them. No.
Has there been, since you've been on my program last, Jossie, any updates from the investigative team?
No, we haven't heard anything about them. I mean, I know that most of them have gone back to Holland. There may be one or two of them left here. We're talking about the Dutch forensic team here.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing we know that they did was they visited the areas, Paul van der Sloot's home, the Kalpoe residence, and they were for a very short while behind the lighthouse, but that's all they did that we know of that was public, because they don't speak to anyone. They shun publicity.
Right.
They won't give out any kind of statement, and they came and they left. Maybe there's one of them or two left on the island, at most.
So they're keeping it quite close to the vest as far as what they've been doing.
Yes. I think they're doing their job the way they used to do it in Holland, because in Holland also they don't go into publicity and all of that.
Right.
And there are some cases they solve, some they don't. I mean, it depends.
Jossie, you and I have both seen the videos. Some have dubbed them the Chicago videos. In one particular video, there's a large clear plastic bag. It looks like it's at the side of a bridge, and beneath that, it looks like a pair of shoes. This video has been out for some time now. I'm wondering if there is a way that either you could help, or if you know if these investigators or forensic investigators have seen this video, analyzed it, and are using it as an investigative aid.
there is no way for us to know, because we tried to contact them to give them a copy of it, because we made a copy specifically on the request of some family members to pass it on to them, but they're invisible. We don't even see them. How can we give a tape to someone we can't see?
Right, exactly. Now, the Amigo article, have there been any follow-up since then?
No, they've kept very quiet because of these outlandish statements that they made, that they cannot back up with anything. This invention of an air ambulance that took her out of the island, etc., etc. I mean, no, it's been very quiet on that front now. And they know that it was just an idea that they had, or some kind of a theory they've sustained from the beginning, but that doesn't have any grounds to stand on.
No, I never saw it personally, but I was told by some of my listeners that there was a link to that article on the Aruban police website. Is there any truth to that?
No, that we have been able to determine, no.
All right. If you're just joining me, the managing editor of Diario is here, Jossie Mansour. Let's get back, Jossie, to the broadcast, and I'm not sure if you've seen an internet copy of it or not, with Bill O'Reilly and Geraldo Rivera the other night. Have you seen that?
I saw parts of it, yes.
Okay, you did see parts of it. Is this a rehash of old speculation that has come out over the past 2 years, that maybe these journalists decided to bring back and try and garner some interest? Because that rumor, as far as drugs and overdose and all that sort of stuff, which was never corroborated, has been heard before. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, this has been around from the beginning. I mean, there is a theory out there that's been sustained on and off for the past two years and 2 months since the case, since the girl disappeared. But we've always considered it only a rumor and only a theory. There is absolutely no facts to back it up, no evidence, nada.
One thing that makes a lot of my listeners scratch their heads, so to speak, and wonder, and myself included, and we've discussed it, but we'll talk about it again, is the fact of the underage drinking and gambling that had been going on, admittedly, by young Vandersloot. Was there ever any discussion, or has there ever been any discussion as far as at least filing some charges as far as that goes?
No, there hasn't been any of that. The authorities have just shrugged it aside. They haven't paid any attention to it then, and they're not paying any attention to it now. And over the past 26 months, I haven't seen anything in the direction of trying to make some kind of a statement, at least, if not bring charges, at least make a statement on this fact, because it is a known fact that as an underage, he wasn't supposed to be in the casino, much less in the company of his father. He was there. There are videotapes to prove that. And still the authorities haven't done anything with regards to that specific case.
Have the authorities been vigilant when it comes to underage drinking and gambling, or do we still see that as a problem in Aruba?
I see it as a problem in Aruba. I mean, they do their best to control it. They're undermanned, they're understaffed, they're underpaid. And I think that in order to be able to bring forth an effective vigilance on that particular subject, I think you need the necessary manpower to do it. I don't think it's being done yet, not with the emphasis that it should be.
The locals, the local population, I'm sure never in their wildest dreams would they have ever thought that there would be so much media attention, some may say negative media attention, towards Aruba because of the lack of progress and the quote-unquote incompetence in this investigation. The man on the street, Jossie, that you sit and you talk to, how would you encapsulate their thoughts on what's going on now, more than 2 years later?
From what we can gather is most of them are disappointed that the case has gone on for so long. No solutions, no real indications of a solution. Even with the coming of these Dutch forensic people, I mean, we haven't seen anything that effectively influences the thoughts of the local population. I mean, they're becoming quite indifferent to it in the sense that they don't see any progress.
And that's what makes things difficult, for sure. So, just before I end up with you, and again, I thank you for coming on the program. You're always a breath of fresh air to come on here. We see so much misinformation and hear so much misinformation. It is disappointing when a program with the ability to attract so much attention as O'Reilly comes forward with this. Do you feel, and I know this, I'm asking you to really speculate here, so that there's going to be more of this negativity? Is there an evil side, for lack of a better term, that's going to keep feeding North American media this crap?
I think that there's a possibility, although I don't see it, in fact, because if you go back to the article that came out in the MEU, that's died out. I mean, there's no consequences to it. No one's interested in it. Like Joran's book, no one paid any attention to it. It's not being commanded anywhere. So it's hard to say exactly what people might think about that.
Yeah, and again, it's difficult, and I know that's maybe not a fair question for me to ask you, but I have the sneaking suspicion that this isn't done yet, but I hope that the North American media will at least research before they report. And if you were to give a piece of advice to a new reporter at your paper, Jossie, what would that be when it comes to source information?
I would say stick to the facts. You don't know the facts, don't write anything about it. Don't give misinformation, because it complicates matters, not only for the reader but for yourself also, because it will blow back in your face sooner or later. I would advise him to stick to the truth and stick to the facts, regardless.
And that's Reporter 101, is it not?
That's it.
Jossie Mansour, thank you, sir.
Quite welcome.
We'll talk to you again soon.
Sure.
Bye-bye. That's Jossie Mansour from Diario. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. In November 2006, the television program Perverted Justice announced that another To Catch a Predator sting had been conducted with law enforcement in Murphy, Texas. There were 25 men who arrived at the filming location over 4 days, with law enforcement investigating additional suspects. Most notably, the additional suspects who conducted chats but did not arrive at the undercover house included a Rockwell County Assistant DA, Lewis Condrit Jr., who later sadly shot and killed himself on November 5th, 2006. I believe the family has now filed suit against NBC and that program. This goes back again to the story of media, and do media people have a code of conduct or even a moral responsibility to make sure that what they're doing on television is right? Of course, we've heard of the Nancy Grace lawsuit and the Duckett family that are suing her and CNN, and a regular contributor to the program, attorney J. Paul Derritani, joins me. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you, Dana?
I'm doing good. Thank you for coming on the program. You know, these programs, this To Catch a Predator, you've seen it, I've seen it, they're fascinating programs, and I think we can all agree that catching the internet predators is important. But it brings back that old question as far as the media and what their role and responsibility is, and should they be doing this in the first place? Because we've heard that a lot of the prosecutions aren't going ahead. In this particular case, the stats here says that all 23 cases brought up against those arrested in this installment were declined to be prosecuted by the prosecutor's office. So is this just ratings, or do they actually have an intent to help here?
Well, you know, I think that, well, certainly any TV show out there is trying to get some ratings to a degree, and, you know, that's their right to do that.
Right.
And I think it's a good show in some ways. I mean, I think it's a valid thing to go after a predator. But the question is the way they go about it. And are they doing the right thing? Are they doing their homework? And that's the problem I have with so many of these shows, including Nancy Grace, and our situation is very, very different than this. But,
yes.
You know, the law on entrapment in every state is different. And in many of these situations, as a lawyer, I've watched this show many times, and I think, well, in many cases, it looks like they're simply entrapping an individual. Certainly, as a parent, a member of society, these people are doing wrong to solicit somebody who is under 18. But when you look deeper into the facts, on some of these sites, obviously, games are played where people play roles and take roles that are different ages, people lie about their ages, and then you have these individuals who go into chat rooms who are, you know, over 18, people, members of Perverted Justice, they're 20, 25, 30-year-old women who say they're under 18 for the pure purpose of trying to catch someone. In one instance, I recall a gentleman was solicited 7 times by a member of Perverted Justice. And, you know, in that situation, in many of these situations, I wonder, you know, are they accomplishing anything by finally catching the bait with this guy and trapping him? He says later that he is, you know, he thought they were over 18, but, you know, she was playing a role. Doesn't mean that it's right what they're doing. I think it's wrong what they're doing. I think if you hear the word under 18, you should shut off your computer and run.
Exactly.
If that's their design. And if their design is to harm or even solicit a young child, obviously, from a member of society standpoint, it's terribly wrong. But these shows, in the Texas situation, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think they prosecuted any of those cases.
No.
So then the question becomes, what's the point?
Yeah.
What are they doing here?
And it defeats the whole purpose of the what the viewer will see as the good intent of trying to catch some of these people. And it brings my next question to you, Counselor. The media and the role of the media, you and I have discussed this many times regarding the Nancy Grace lawsuit. What is the role of the media? Are television personalities, investigators, police officers, first of all, they're not trained to do this. There's a different sort of a genre now in television where the public has this craving to see this kind of stuff on TV. You and I never saw this when we were growing up. We watched Leave It to Beaver and the Brady Bunch and that kind of thing.
Right.
And you wouldn't imagine those types of programs on in those days, but now we see this sort of stuff, and it seems to be doing more harm than good. Your comments?
I think that's a very valid point, and it's sort of a gotcha mentality that seems to be engaged by the media. In other words, in many of these reality television shows, whether it's or even these shows where they put entertainers or people that are coming on to entertain, it's to humiliate or get somebody. And I'm all in favor of the law, and I'm all in favor of the police getting somebody who is violating the law. But this show, And I think there's some good in the show. I don't want to say that there's no good in the show, but
right.
I question whether they're doing their homework. That's the big issue here. It's not necessarily that, you know, they are getting somebody who winds up being prosecuted. And to their credit, they have had some prosecution. And I think Perverted Justice has some good goals. And if it's to catch these people who are sexual predators, that's fine. But is there a sort of a effect where they're possibly even increasing the number of predators? Are they enticing people? Are they entrapping people? And are they looking at the law? And that's what's very, very sad, even, you know, with the situation with Nancy Grace. So often you see her going off on different guests, and yet she doesn't have the facts correct. And time after, and I've been on many TV shows, including MSNBC, and that, to their credit, they were pretty thorough. Fox News, I thought they were very unthorough when they interviewed me. You know, that's just my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And in this show, you see where in Texas, they weren't able to catch the predator, in fact, because they didn't follow the law. They didn't look at the law sufficiently enough, to my understanding, so that the DA could go ahead and prosecute these individuals. So if somebody's out there playing a game, and he's on the internet, and he's talking to a woman over 25 or 30, and they know it, and they're both playing games, but then somebody else comes on Perverted Justice and says they're under 18 just simply to try to get them, and he's never acted on it. As a lawyer, yeah, a different hat that I'm putting on, but as a lawyer, I view that as entrapment.
Absolutely.
I don't think that's sufficient. There's enough real criminals out there to catch so that you don't have to go and entrap people.
Whose responsibility is it for ensuring that the media follow a code of conduct, so to speak? A lot of media people will claim, First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, etc., etc. But it's got to the point now where we see the case of the reporter. He puts a bathing suit on and goes for a swim with a murder suspect or a suspect in the disappearance of his wife. We seem to have this undercover mentality. This get the story at all costs, let's report it, and if it's wrong, well, we'll try and fix it later. But people are dying, and that's the unfortunate thing. How do we fix this?
That's right. Well, I think it's a twofold thing. You have the gotcha mentality combined with the get the story mentality. Get the story at all costs, and we want to see that sensational bit of gotcha. We want to catch that person. And trained psychologists, trained police officers, they should be going after these individuals. I'm not saying that a group like Perverted Justice doesn't have some role to help. And there's assistive groups out there. I mean, go back to our day and you had Neighborhood Watch. I think
right.
It's wonderful. I think it's a great organization. But when they go and take that next step, especially journalists, it doesn't seem that the FCC, and that's the governing body, it doesn't seem that the various organizations that govern these journalists are doing their job to make sure that they're doing fact check, legal checks, and before they put somebody on the air that they then say and ruin their career, their family, and everything else, because it's one thing to have even a fine or a jail sentence or something like that, but they're usually destroying these people. And believe me, some of them probably, their career should be destroyed.
Right.
But in some cases, you can't paint with such a broad brush. And before they go on the air, they should know the law in that state, and maybe they should see if this person has been prosecuted. Because if the DA is going to drop the charges and there isn't sufficient evidence, then a moral, ethical question, regardless of whether they can do something, but an ethical question needs to be asked, which is, well, am I going to, there it wasn't sufficient evidence, says the law enforcement, says the prosecution. So am I going to go forward with showing this tape to millions of people and ruining this person's relationship with their spouse, this person's career, and everything else? Because maybe it was purely entrapment.
Yeah, well said. And it takes me back to your case with the Duckett family and the Nancy Grace Show running the interview after they knew that the young lady had taken her life. And that's just hugely despicable in my books. Give us an update on that case, Counselor.
Sure, absolutely. First, it's a whole different animal than the entrapment, the predator, because
absolutely.
We don't think that Melinda did anything wrong. We
right.
still believe that the murderer is out there, and we hope that he's found. And I'm still going on radio, and thank you for having me on this show. And
yeah.
Hopefully somewhere some lead is going to come up, which is going to show who took this baby. But at this point, we don't have somebody apprehended. But the bottom line is, at this point, the case is now going forward in federal court. They, to our disappointment, the federal court has indicated that they do not believe we have sufficient evidence at this time to have Joshua Duckett named in the case, and that's the child's father,
right?
To name in the case, because we had questions over what was done with the money. In other words, money that was sent in to find Trenton, the baby, seems to be at odds with, or let me say it this way, we have questions over the money that was sent in and whether it was used appropriately by the trust. The trust has been dismissed from the case. We are going forward with Ms. Grace, the case against Ms. Grace and the case against CNN. And, we'll see. We think we have a good likelihood of winning because we think it's not about the First Amendment. We think it's about defrauding an individual into going on the show under false pretenses.
Yep. Yep, I agree with you, and it'll be an interesting case to follow. J. Paul Derritani, thanks for stopping by.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Always a pleasure.
Always.
Talk to you later. Bye. Bye-bye. And we'll be right back here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Hi, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. Let's Bring Them Home is a national missing persons advocacy group, and they've announced the launch of Project Dead Zone. It's an initiative to find answers in cases of missing persons along the 100-mile stretch from Shreveport, Louisiana to Houston, Texas, that is dubbed as the Dead Zone. Representatives from Let's Bring Them Home are slated or were in Shreveport on July 20th to join Carolyn Johnson, who's been on my program, mother of missing man Clinton Nelson, on a quest to find answers regarding the Dead Zone. And here on Scared Monkeys Radio, we're on that same quest. We have LaDonna Meredith with us to talk about this. Let's talk about Project Dead Zone. Welcome, LaDonna.
Thank you. We appreciate being a part of the show.
Yeah, nice to have you. Let's talk about this 100-mile stretch from Shreveport, Louisiana to Houston, Texas. You hear that term dead zone, it kind of creeps you out a little bit, but this isn't something to laugh about. It's pretty serious.
Yeah, it's very serious. We know that in the last 10 years alone, dozens of men, women, and children have disappeared between that 100-mile stretch between Shreveport, Louisiana, and Houston, Texas. Many of the victims have been found murdered, but many of them have never been seen again.
You know, this is, we're not talking, one life lost is tragic, but we're talking, again, hundreds. This is a logistical nightmare. It's a huge problem. Let's talk about law enforcement and the response to this.
You know, it's hard to, you know, accurately define the response that law enforcement has given this dead zone area in the past, because what we have found is that each of the cases are dealt with individual law enforcement agencies within counties and parishes throughout Texas, Louisiana, and even Arkansas. But what we are finding is that the media is catching on to this story, and organizations such as ours that are really, you know, getting out there, hitting the streets and letting people know that this is a problem and it needs to be addressed, is bringing law enforcement together. And that's what we hope to accomplish with Project Dead Zone.
Absolutely. Bringing law enforcement in a cooperative manner together to work with each other, not against each other, to solve this, because this is pretty serious. Now, we've featured the Clinton Nelson story on the show, and I'm just going to mention it again. Nelson, 21, was last seen Friday, September 1st, 2006, at a approximately 8:30, leaving a friend's house in the vicinity of Ward Lane and Highway 80 in Princeton, Louisiana. He was last seen wearing a black t-shirt, blue jeans, black knit cap, and white tennis shoes. A reward totaling $12,500 is offered for information leading to Clinton's whereabouts and information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person responsible for this disappearance. Is it looked at that this Clinton Nelson disappearance is part of that 100-mile stretch?
Well, I mean, it definitely falls within that 100-mile stretch. And because, you know, we don't know how many of these cases are related, we do know that there are two known serial killers that have been caught. One is Robert Charles Brown. He's confessed to at least three of the killings there and 45 more around the country. And then there was a former truck driver named James Wood, and he's been charged with different crimes. But many of the crimes were committed in the same fashion. Others were not. So it's hard to say how many were related to one or two or more serial killers that are in that area. But what we do know is that it's still happening. Somebody or, you know, many people are still getting away with these crimes because they're not being looked at seriously enough.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to do what we can to bring the public and law enforcement attention to them. Let's Bring Them Home is the advocacy group that you're part of. Tell the folks about it.
Well, Let's Bring Them Home is a nonprofit organization. We provide resources, solutions, and assistance on behalf of the families of missing adults and children. And we do that by providing public relations assistance. We help develop safety programs and education initiatives. Our criteria for cases is that there has to have been a police report filed on the missing person, and that's just about it. You know, a lot of our cases are cold cases, or they're cases that involve alcohol or substance abuse where other organizations won't step in and help them. And so ours is unique in the fact that, you know, as long as we've got that filed police report, then we can get involved immediately. And, you know, it's been well embraced across the nation. You know, we send a team out to every town that we take a case in, and we sit down with the family and law enforcement, and we take the necessary steps to get the case back in the media, and that's what we've been doing in Shreveport the last few days.
How did things go on the 20th?
Well, you know, we went into the Shreveport area to begin with. We distributed between the three of us hundreds of flyers. We hit every convenience store in Shreveport, and then we went down what is known as the dead zone and hit a good 50 miles of that 100-mile stretch and just made people aware of the problem. We hung posters talking about the dead zone and gave them information about some of the people who were missing. And what we're offering is an 800 number. It's toll-free. It's no cops involved. We just want anybody that has information about any of those crimes committed along the dead zone to give us a call. No matter how small the information is, it's important. And what we hope to do is to put together a task force from our organization and law enforcement all along the dead zone to see what we can do to get some of these cases solved and to make that route safer.
Let's share that toll-free number with the folks.
Absolutely. That number is 1-866-479-5284. And what happens when you call that number? There's not a live person. It's a recording that gives you a message, thanks you for calling, and it's completely anonymous. You can talk as long as you want. You can call as often as you want. But that line does not go to law enforcement. And I think that will be attractive to people who know anything or have even participated in some of those crimes along the dead zone.
Absolutely. And the website I see here is www.letsbringthemhome.org. Again, that's www.letsbringthemhome.org. Just before I let you go, LaDonna, how shocked are the people that are out there, the, you know, Joe and Mary six-pack that are living their lives, to hear about the dead zone and to hear about how many people are missing each year? It's I find through my program, and we feature a lot of missing person cases here, that the public just isn't aware, and they're shocked to hear how many.
Well, I mean, you're exactly right. They, in my experience just over the last few days of being in that area, they were shocked. Many of the people lived within a 5-mile radius of some of these missing persons, you know, Clinton included, didn't even know that they were gone, didn't realize that this was truly an epidemic and that it could affect them. And, you know, we hope to make a difference through this project so people become more aware and they can take a look at some of these cases, they can learn how to protect themselves and just be aware of the surroundings and, you know, all of us be better citizens because we're aware of these crimes that are happening and that we can do our part to help prevent them in the future.
So important. That is so true. LaDonna, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And we'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. And that's it. I want to thank my guests this evening and remind you that these shows are podcast and are available for you at www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. That's www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio. There you can pick up shows from the past, tonight's show, my daily commentary, or whatever. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.